Good evening. It is doubtful whether there is a man or a woman alive in Kalamazoo today who can remember when there wasn't a Republican Party and a Democratic Party. Of course, there was such a time, many, many years ago. George Washington, our first president, deplored the political factions which sprang up in his day and prophesied that they would be the ruination of the country. Then, as now, there were two major parties, but they were not called Democrats and Republicans. They were called Federalists and Anti-Federalists. The Federalists had been the ones who supported the ratification of the Constitution in the several states. On the whole, they were the educated, the rich, and the powerful. The little people generally opposed the Constitution, and had all of them had the right to vote, they undoubtedly would have rejected it. But in those times, only about one out of every five or six adult males possessed the right of the franchise. The champion of the Anti-Federalists was Thomas Jefferson. In the election of 1800, his party voted down the Federalists and made him president. The Federalists never won another national election. Jefferson called his party the Republicans, but of course it was not the same party which we call Republican today. Jefferson's enemies dubbed his party Democrats. Democracy was not popular in those days, and to call a man a Democrat was almost the equivalent of calling a man a communist today. The Federalists said Jefferson and his party would ruin the country. Of course, they didn't. And in due course, they took over many of the old Federalist policies. Within 15 years, the Federalists had dwindled to a small New England faction. Virtually, there was only one party in the nation for about 15 years, from 1815 to 1830. In the year 1824, no candidate for the presidency received a clear majority of the electoral vote. Andrew Jackson of Tennessee had the largest number, and he was trailed by the Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, son of the second president, William Crawford, and Henry Clay. Under the Constitution, in such circumstances, the election is thrown into the House of Representatives, and the House in that case chose Adams. When Clay was named Secretary of State by Adams, Jackson's followers yelled, "Corrupt bargain!" You see, for many years, the Secretary of State had succeeded to the presidency. The Jacksonites claimed that Adams' supporters had promised Clay this office in return for his votes. Well, that set the stage for the election of 1828. This time, Old Hickory got a clear majority. And again, the wise, the educated, and the refined people of the country heaved a groan, just as they had when Jefferson took office. This time, though, it was worse. From the Wild West, men wearing coonskin caps, unlettered and uncultured, swarmed all over the White House at the inauguration reception, spilled punch on the carpets, and generally made the place a shambles. And once in power, Jackson turned out of office appointees of Adams and previous presidents by the hundreds, men whom everyone recognized as well qualified. What was the country coming to? This wild man proceeded to antagonize people right and left. When John Marshall, Chief Justice of the United States, rendered a decision in which Old Hickory was not in agreement, he is reputed to have said, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it." When South Carolina, under the leadership of John C. Calhoun, nullified a federal law, Jackson threatened to use force to compel obedience and privately vowed that he would hang John C. Calhoun if he didn't stop this foolishness. He collided with the mighty Daniel Webster on the issue of the United States Bank. Now, this private banking institution, which was a depository for national funds, was regarded by Jackson as a powerful corporate monster, and he determined to get rid of it. The mighty Daniel was not above accepting a retainer on the side from the bank while sitting in Congress. Henry Clay of Kentucky also sided with the bank. Its charter was due to run out in 1836, but Clay, feeling that the people would support the bank, pushed through a bill to recharter it in 1832, just in order to put Andrew Jackson behind the eight ball. If he signed the bill, he would have to swallow his own words. If he vetoed it, then he would be blamed by the country for destroying a useful institution, so thought Henry Clay. By this time, the enemies of Old Hickory were beginning to organize to oust this monster. They took the name National Republicans. But this was not the Republican Party we know either, and the name didn't stick. Pretty soon, folks took to calling this new party the Whig Party. You see, Jackson's enemies had pictured him as a dictator, as a tyrant. A current cartoon shows him sitting on a throne, clothed in ermine, wearing a crown and wielding a scepter. That made his enemies think of English history and the Whig party in that country, which was against the attempts of the king to seize absolute power. Well, Jackson vetoed this bank bill. Clay chuckled, thought he could win the presidency to which the Whigs had nominated him. But the people of the country ruled otherwise. One of the results of Jacksonian democracy was the extension of the right to vote in most of the states to every adult male. To frontiersmen, the small farmers and merchants, the little people generally, Old Hickory was a god. He could do no wrong. Jackson was reelected, and Clay returned to Congress. One of the notorious episodes in Jackson's administration was the Peggy Eaton affair. Peggy Eaton, a former barmaid who had separated from her first husband, was the wife of cabinet member John Eaton. Most of the other cabinet members and their wives gave Peggy the cold shoulder. This made Jackson furious. He recalled the gossip about his own beloved wife, Rachel, whom he had married before she had a divorce from her first husband, although he didn't know it. There was one cabinet member who was nice to Peggy. That was Martin Van Buren of New York, who happened to be a bachelor. Probably this played no small part in making Van Buren Jackson's successor in the White House in 1837. Among the men whom Jackson had called to Washington to become a member of his rapidly changing cabinet was Lewis Cass, who had made an enviable record as governor of Michigan Territory from 1815 to 1830. Jackson himself, a man of the frontier, could appreciate frontier virtues. He watched with pleasure the rapid growth of the West, and especially of Michigan, during the early years of his administration. And then he began to be alarmed as speculators in public lands got to buying land not for settlement, but for rapid turnover. He saw them establish banks which issued currency which had no backing, and then use this currency to buy more land. Finally, he issued his specie circular, which ordered that henceforth all public lands must be paid for with hard money. As a direct outcome of this, land values crashed and the Panic of 1837 ensued. But by that time, Andrew was back at the Hermitage, and Martin Van Buren got the blame. The Whigs by this time were firmly established as an opposition party. In Michigan, the backbone of the early Whig party was a group of three Detroit men who had been appointed to positions in the territorial government by President John Quincy Adams. There was no love lost between Jackson and the appointees of Adams, and so it was natural that these men should lead the fight against King Andrew. They were William Woodbridge, Henry S. Chipman, and Thomas Rowland. Outside Detroit, the rank and file was staunchly pro-Jackson, and the first state election resulted in the choice of Stevens T. Mason, a Democrat, as governor, and the entire Democratic ticket. In those early days, you could hear men talking politics everywhere. In the taverns, in front of the meeting house of a Sunday after dinner at harvest time, at camp meetings in the summer, around the Cracker Barrel and the general store in winter, in fact, anywhere that masculinity congregated. Women, of course, had no part in these talks. Politics was a man's game in those days. And a sort of a game it was, too. A sporting interest, like Major League Baseball, is today to many people. You followed your party and supported it, come what might. Every year, there was at least one election. Michigan elected its state officers in the odd-numbered years until 1850. And in the even-numbered years, there always were congressmen to choose, and each 4 years, a presidential election. In between, there was always a contest brewing for a township or county office. In the history books, you will read a lot about Jacksonian democracy. Just how much Old Hickory himself had to do with it is open to question. The main influence seems to be the enfranchisement of so many new voters by the states, giving thousands of people the right to vote for the first time. Slowly the idea got around that one man was just as good as another to hold public office. Elections should be frequent, and as many offices as possible should be made elective. Michigan's first state constitution was drafted before this point of view became as prevalent as it became later. That first constitution provided for the election by the people of the governor and the legislature, but virtually all the other state officials were made appointive by the governor. For example, in those days, the superintendent of public instruction, the regents of the university, and the secretary of state were all appointive offices. When the second state constitution was drafted in 1850, all that was changed. These and many other offices were made elective by the people. Well, that was the influence of the first flush of true democracy. Curiously enough, today, almost a century after that second Michigan Constitution, we are beginning to move back toward the earlier and probably sounder idea of electing only a few of the major policy-determining officials. There are today so many offices filled by election that our ballots are long and complicated. It is difficult for the voter to cast an intelligent ballot. On most offices, he has no sound basis for making a decision. One of the reforms advocated by Governor Kim Sigler and supported by most authorities on government is a shorter ballot. Since the Civil War, political parties have not been well balanced in Michigan. During most of the period, the Republican Party has been dominant and the Democratic Party has been weak. But back in the days before the war between the states, the power of the rival parties was much more evenly balanced. The Democrats usually won state elections in those days, but the Whig opposition always was formidable. And in Kalamazoo County, the Whigs usually had the majority. Next week, we will bring you the story of politics in Michigan and in Kalamazoo County in those days in greater detail. Now, this is Willis Dunbar bidding you a most pleasant good night.